Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, we will speak with the state health officer about growing numbers of COVID-19 cases and deaths.
We are seeing high levels of transmission really everywhere in the state at this point. And one of the most concerning things that we are seeing is, of course, the increase in hospitalizations.
It turns out there may be at least one positive that comes out of the pandemic. That's access to telehealth in rural areas.
I think that we are now locked into a new paradigm of how we deliver healthcare in a rural setting.
And we will learn about a new form of poetry that was invented with the help of a Wyoming poet. It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. After a summer with relatively few serious cases of COVID-19, Wyoming's hospitals are full, and the death toll is rising. Even the governor and the first lady have contracted the coronavirus, and it shows no signs of letting up. State Health Officer Dr. Alexia Harris joins me now to discuss the virus, face coverings, and the vaccine. I want to just start off and just talk about something that's very obvious in our state right now. We're seeing more fatalities than we've ever seen, and the numbers don't seem to be getting better. I just thought maybe a great place to start is, you know, what's going on and what's your thoughts on what's happening in the state right now?
Yes, well, thank you, Bob, for having me. And certainly we are very concerned about what is happening in the state right now. It is, of course, heartbreaking to see so many deaths, especially recently from COVID-19. And that, unfortunately, we know comes with having increased transmission levels in our state, which we certainly do right now, as well as increased hospitalizations. We are seeing high levels of transmission really everywhere in the state at this point. And one of the most concerning things that we are seeing is, of course, the increase in hospitalizations. One of our goals during this whole pandemic has been to make sure that we are able to maintain our healthcare capacity so that everybody who needs healthcare in hospitals, you know, whether it be from COVID or whether it be from any other condition, is able to access a healthcare provider, able to access the highest level of care. And that's what we're concerned about right now. The main concern for our hospitals seems to be at this point staffing, that because of both the volume of patients and because of the number of staff that are out because of either having been exposed to COVID or actually having COVID, that we've needed to supplement at this point some of their staffing to make sure that they can care for all of their patients. So that is something that we're watching very closely and are concerned about.
One of the things you just said I thought was very interesting, and that's the fact that you're starting to see it come in all kinds of areas. I was going to tell you maybe a month ago it looked like the nursing home outbreaks and that kind of thing were really what was driving everything, but you're seeing it all over the place?
Yes, it really is all over the place. There's not a specific location or really, you know, kind of a specific type of activity that you can pinpoint many of the transmission events to at this point. We are, again, seeing it in locations throughout the state. And it is simply the case that, you know, really any time that you are gathering with somebody outside of your household, attending events, that does put you at increased risk of contracting COVID-19 because of how prevalent it is. But we also know that there are certainly certain types of activities that pose that higher risk, and that's where we're seeing transmission. And those are gatherings of people, you know, from multiple households where we're not seeing precautions taken, such as mask use, such as distancing, and such as, you know, staying home when you are having symptoms, even if they're mild symptoms, because that can still be COVID-19. And so those, you know, those types of gatherings do pose a greater risk. And it's why we're really asking people and really emphasizing, and it's more important than ever to take those simple but very important precautions of trying to distance yourself from others, not gathering with others when you don't have to do it, wearing face coverings and staying home when you're sick.
There's been a lot of clamor, of course, as you well know, for a mask mandate. So I'm curious what you think something like that might do for us as a state if you decided to go in that direction.
Sure. So the evidence that face masks prevent, you know, me, for example, if I had COVID-19 and didn't know it, from spreading it to others is really growing. And we also know that the more people that are wearing masks, again, in those situations, especially indoors, especially when it's difficult to maintain a distance from people outside of your households, the more people that are wearing those masks, the more effective that we will be in slowing transmission of this virus. It really is a simple step to take. To wear your mask to protect others. And we think that that's really important and want as many people to be doing that, wearing masks indoors when they're around people from who are not in their households as much as possible. We are certainly very, I'm very happy to see that 16 of our 23 counties have those mask orders in place for those specific types of situations. And I do think that those have resulted in increased mask use in those areas. And we are working on extending those county orders right now to make sure that they continue to be in place. There really should be no question right now about how the Department of Health feels about face masks, that people should be wearing them, and it helps our communities, it helps our businesses stay open, it helps our schools stay open if we can wear face coverings in those situations. I think it's also important to remember, though, that while face coverings are a very important and effective tool, they are not the only tool, and they in and of themselves, will not, stop the spread of COVID-19. We need to use face coverings in conjunction with those other measures that I talked about. So even with face coverings, still limiting gatherings is important. Still maintaining physical distancing is important. And probably the most important of all is staying home when you feel sick.
Is there going to be an appropriate time to go back and revisit closures of any sort?
We are always considering whether we need more restrictive measures such as closures. Obviously, we know that closures have a big impact on people, their ability to have a job, their ability to operate their business. And so we obviously would prefer to do other things like having people wear face coverings, which I think can help prevent those types of closures. But at the same time, we are considering everything. Everything is on the table. And as always, we will make the decisions based on the data that we're seeing.
Alexia Harris, she is your state health officer visiting with us today. But by the way, I wanted to go back and follow up. Do you anticipate calling for a state mask mandate, or are you leaving that up to the communities?
So the governor, has spoken about the desire for having local control as much as possible. And that's the situation where we are now. But again, everything is on the table. And if, we feel that a statewide mask order is needed, that is certainly something that we will consider.
Are you surprised how overwhelmed the hospitals have gotten?
I wouldn't say I'm surprised. I think because of the steps that we took as a state early on in this pandemic, we were successful in slowing transmission, which I think was very important in essentially buying us some time to be more prepared for this situation. We were able to acquire and make sure we had enough supplies of that personal protective equipment that healthcare providers need. We were able to make sure we have enough testing so that anyone with symptoms, any close contacts, And now really anybody in the state can get tested if they'd like to sort of develop those appropriate tools and those necessary tools to combat this pandemic. Healthcare providers are certainly much more familiar now with treating COVID patients, which I think is important. And of course, we are closer to a vaccine now than we were in the spring and summer. But we were able, of course, to observe other places that saw high levels of transmission earlier than we did. And knowing that this virus can cause severe disease, not in everybody, many people have mild symptoms, but many people also have severe symptoms. And so we knew that the more cases we would see, the more hospitalizations would be required. So unfortunately, we can predict or expect that if we can continue to see increasing transmission in our communities, we will continue to see increasing hospitalizations and deaths.
So where do things look like to you as we head for the next 2 or 3 months?
So I think people should be very hopeful about the vaccine. The news that we're hearing about the effectiveness of the vaccine is very promising. And I really think that we are able to look at that as a light at the end of a tunnel, the tunnel. We have an end in sight at this point, which was not true for many months during this pandemic. We have what we think is going to be an effective vaccine. But in the meantime, if we can sort of hunker down and take these precautions for a few more months, we are going to be able to prevent deaths as we wait the vaccine to be available, widely available in the community.
42% of people polled say they don't want to take a vaccine. How do you overcome that so this thing doesn't continue?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that while certainly the process of, making this vaccine available in the United States is faster than the usual processes for making vaccines available, it is still very rigorous, and that health officials at both the Food and Drug Administration and an independent panel of scientists will be carefully reviewing all of the data that are available for these vaccines before they authorize its use and before they recommend its use. And so these vaccines, will be studied. The data will be reviewed before they're available. And I think it's important for people to understand that process, and that process ensures that we will have as safe a vaccine as possible.
I know you were actually talking about this today as we talk. I'm curious, do you anticipate following the federal guidelines and providing them to healthcare workers and some of the elderly population first?
Yes, we do plan on following those guidelines from the from that independent panel of scientists that advises the CDC in terms of the order in which we will provide vaccinations when we have limited supply of vaccine. And so those healthcare providers that are caring for patients and those individuals who are more at risk for bad outcomes will be top on our list for vaccine.
And when do you think the average person might get a shot at some of this?
Well, I will avoid predicting the future because that usually is a good way to be wrong. But I do think that, it won't be right away. We will have to wait some time until the vaccines are produced in an amount that they're really available for the general public. So I think we still need to have some patience and be prepared to wait a number of months until we arrive at that point.
Good luck in the next few weeks, Dr. Harris. I know the job doesn't get any easier. And thank you so much for making yourself available and for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Bob. Again, I really appreciate your having me.
Later in the show, we will discuss one positive aspect of the pandemic. That's the rise in telemedicine. In a moment, we will discuss a lawsuit directed towards a treatment center in Clark, Wyoming, and learn how budget cuts could impact libraries in the state. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West, Ron was finally making progress healing his PTSD, but then the pandemic came along.
I said, I really don't want to sit in front of a computer for an hour. It's just not my thing.
The Doctor in the Screen, part 6 of our ghost hunting series. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Earlier this week, a federal class action lawsuit was filed against Trinity Teen Solution. The private Christian residential treatment center in Clark, Wyoming, is for girls between the ages of 12 and 17. 25 girls have filed the suit, saying that they were mentally and physically abused while at the facility. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaks with Cody Enterprise reporter Leo Wolfson, who broke the story. Wolfson has been investigating the facility since March of 2019.
We saw reports of abuse coming in regards to the Trinity Teen Solutions facility in Clark. So I decided to look into this as much as possible and see what was available on these reports. The sheriff's office didn't have much that they could offer at the time beyond the very basics that we pretty much already knew. So I decided to reach out to see if I could find any girls who had been to Trinity Teen Solutions and see if they if their experiences there matched up with any of these reports of abuse.
Okay, and what were the reports of abuse?
Through the sheriff's office, there was nothing of any details, extremely vague. We were just reading off the blotter, basically a synopsis of kind of what I just told you. So to be able to get to see what the details were, I had to physically reach out to girls who had gone there, and that's where I ended up getting a lot more details from their experiences. There was also a 2016 lawsuit involving Trinity Teen Solutions with girls who had made disparaging comments and basically gave very negative reviews of Trinity Teen Solutions on Yelp. I was able to lock down a few of the names of the girls who were involved in that case because the case was public at one point, even though it was settled. So it's very easy to find those names. Those girls, they basically couldn't say anything on the record because of the settlement, but they pointed me to girls that were not involved in that who could speak.
And so when you were reaching out to these girls, what did you find out once you started talking to them?
They gave me some very strong details about some allegations of very harsh treatment, definitely some allegations of abuse, food deprivation, sleep deprivation, extremely hard labor conditions, poorly insulated living conditions, very, very strict punishments, and basically kind of an overall encompassing mantra of using punishments to basically heal, to basically use punishments as strictly as a lesson to improve these girls, these troubled girls' lives.
And I'm wondering, when you're reaching out to these girls, the class action lawsuit didn't come about yet, right? Because that's pretty recent.
So yes, I did a huge bulk of my reporting for this story way back in March of 2019. We decided to not go forward with any of the information I had received and written at that time, because we wanted to wait until any kind of legal filings were charged, but it never happened. I really had almost pretty much given up on this ever being a public story. And then just this past 2 weeks ago, I was given notice from one of the girls that there was going to be a federal filing submitted in federal civil court regarded to Trinity Teens. And then I reached out to their attorney, and he verified this account.
And so what is the class action lawsuit?
The allegations and charges thereby include 2 counts forced labor and then 1 count each for trafficking, racketeering, negligence, and negligent infliction of emotional distress.
What does Trinity Teen Solutions say to this?
I reached out to Angela Woodward, the co-owner of Trinity Teen Solutions, and she denied all of the allegations. She finds it to be a money grab. She says they've been investigated numerous times by Wyoming Department of Family Services, Wyoming Division of Criminal Investigations, and there's been no findings of any legitimacy to any claims now or in these same claims that have been brought up in the past. And she's just basically saying that these are very troubled girls who have a lot of mental issues, psychiatric issues, and that there's no substance behind any of this, and she stands behind their treatment 100%.
Where is the case going to go now once it's been filed?
Well, it, like I said, it'll be heard in Wyoming federal court. In all likelihood, this case is going to take years, I expect. and many people will be paying a close attention to this case. I can tell you that, especially within the behavioral health and just mental health industries in Wyoming and probably nationwide as well.
And why do you say that?
Because of the troubled teen industry is an industry I think that is one that I've seen getting a lot of attention garnered toward it in the last couple of years, as far as these allegations of abuse and allegations of these organizations profiting off human labor and offering, you know, therapeutic help by essentially making their residents do chores. And I think it's an industry that was already a little bit under the microscope, and it sounds like, at least from a lot of my sources, is kind of headed in that direction for a lot of different facilities, even not even obviously facilities far outside this Northwest Wyoming region. These facilities are located all across the country in many different shapes and sizes. And it's an industry in certain states that appears to be relatively unregulated. Wyoming in particular is extremely unregulated.
Do you know how Wyoming regulates these troubled teen establishments, facilities?
The licensing is obviously huge, and then the Wyoming Department of Family Services is plays a huge part in the supervision or the management, so to speak, because these are minors, almost predominantly all minors at these treatment centers. So it falls under their purview. And just from my food sources I've talked to, I know that Wyoming is definitely much less regulated than some other states.
Well, thanks so much for talking to me, Leo.
Yeah, no problem. No problem.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska speaking with Cody Enterprise reporter Leo Wolfson. Now we will turn our attention to budget cuts, specifically to libraries. Several libraries across the state are facing such budget cuts. To save money, many services went online. But how do libraries handle patrons with no access to the internet? Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner found out how COVID-19 is affecting what our libraries can provide.
Hear that? That's the sound of a library. And sure, libraries are supposed to be quiet places, but right now it's extra quiet. Before COVID-19 health restrictions, the Riverton Library was seeing 450 people on average per day, with a staff of 10 assistant librarians. Sherry Haskins is the branch manager at Riverton Public Library.
Once we started going through the budget cuts and working on our fiscal budget as is for 2021, we had to reduce that staff to 4, including, and with me, that makes a staff of 5 people.
Haskins has been working here for 22 years. The budget here has been cut by 30%, the highest of any library system in the state. And while some libraries can use reserves in the interim, next year's budget brings with it a lot of uncertainty. Johnson, Uinta, Lincoln, and Crook counties also took substantial cuts to their budgets. Jamie Marcus is the state librarian in Cheyenne, and he says that normally when the state falls on economic hard times, visits to the library go up.
But again, overall, our libraries are looking at a rather significant cut next year or mid-year. It just sort of depends on how tax revenues start to show up.
Libraries can provide free internet that people need when they're out of work to search for jobs.
It's natural that most folks who may lose an income or are looking at a reduced income may cut back services to their home, whether that be cable, internet, or for goodness sakes, food, unfortunately. So the public library becomes a place for those affected individuals to go to, again, use a public access computer to work on their resume, to take a course from the public library on how to write a resume, to visit one of the various programs that will take place in the library to talk about workforce service options.
But now with budgets in flux and COVID-19 restrictions, providing these services are becoming tricky. Marcus also says that libraries are important because they provide information to relevant health and safety regulations that are in constant flux due to COVID-19. On average, per day, 12,500 items were being checked out across the state before COVID. And while some counties have seen an uptick in how many materials are being checked out due to people staying in, other programming has had to disappear or move online. Jacob Mickelson is the president of the Wyoming Library Association, and the director of the Carbon County Public Library. Nicholson says it is hard to tally the exact economic boost that a library can provide its community, but remains positive about how the future looks for the state's libraries.
There's an additional vital service that involves putting people inside of our facilities, and I think that is going to be the biggest hurdle we have to overcome until COVID goes away.
Mickelson says many counties have upgraded their offerings online, and since the librarians across the state stay in constant contact with each other, most have found their footing to keep people safe for the next few months. Back in Riverton, being short-staffed has drastically affected the help Haskins and her employees can provide. Fremont County provides library assistance to the surrounding area of Pavilion, Shoshone, and the Wind River Indian Reservation. Haskins says Riverton Library is busy trying to help new patrons apply for COVID-19 stimulus money.
We are seeing more people that have never been on a computer before because you can't do anything without an email address.
Haskins says that libraries are needed more than ever as a resource for the Riverton community. And she questions where else people could go for help if the library had to shut its doors again. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
When we come back, we will look at how the pandemic is helping make mental health treatment available to more people. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Mo was a professional climber, but when a friend asked her to go on a longer expedition, she hesitated.
If you want to try rock climbing, this is not the story that's going to make you want to do it. You're not always wet for 2.5 weeks straight and pooping in someone else's Ziploc bag.
The Unclimbables. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. For years, it's been very difficult to get mental health services to rural places like Wyoming. A big part of the issue is the lack of mental health providers and the fact that people frequently would have to drive for over an hour for such services. But then the pandemic hit, and everyone in the country suddenly needed telehealth. And this has led to a possible solution to the mental health access problem. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska follows a National Guard veteran on his telehealth journey to address his PTSD.
And then I hit connect.
Early one morning, National Guard veteran Ron Laporto sits down on his exercise ball in front of a laptop to log into his telehealth session, like he's been doing weekly for the past month or so.
Good morning. I'm having trouble hearing you right now. Can you hear me? For some reason, this is the first time I've ever had static.
After a couple more moments of trying to figure out what's wrong, they decide to use the phone to hear each other, but stay on video so that they can still see each other.
Sure, I can see you and I can hear you fine over the phone.
When I meet Laporto after he finishes his session, he says this was the first time he's encountered technical problems. Laporto has been using telehealth for his sessions since March, when the Sheridan VA announced it was closing its doors to the public due to COVID-19. Technical glitches and just not being able to get the same results was one of the things Laporto was originally worried about when he couldn't go into the office for his appointments.
But my psychologist, again, she called me and she said, you can't come to the office. We'd like you to try this VVC, VA Video Connect. I said, I really don't want to sit in front of a computer for an hour. It's just not my thing.
He realized it probably would be better to still have some kind of session with his psychologist versus the possibility of the episodes coming back. It turns out Laporto's provider was herself, a reluctant telehealth convert.
So my full name is Robin Lipke, and I'm a clinical psychologist in the outpatient mental health clinic at the Sheridan VAMC.
Lipke has done telehealth in the past, but it was always done with an intermediary. This means an individual arrived at a clinic somewhere in Wyoming, was checked in by a nurse, and then would enter a room where there was a screen that Lipke would appear on. For Lipke, the second set of eyes was important. But she says COVID-19 really made her realize telehealth was the best alternative, especially when she started to notice that patients started opening up a different way at home.
As we were talking, they might say, oh, you see this photograph back here, and might start talking about something that I might not have gotten if we were only in the office.
It turns out telehealth is the solution to a number of issues beyond mental health. Alan Morgan is the CEO of the nonprofit National Rural Health Association. Morgan says the long distances between small towns to larger areas limits access to health care.
The real concern is you just can't get specialty care to live and work in a rural community, and telehealth has the potential to bridge this.
Morgan says everyone is discovering that telehealth can address most concerns.
We need to start realizing that you've got telebehavioral health, you got telepharmacy, you have teleradiology, telecardiology. All these have different roles and different applications, and they really need to be thought of separately. Telehealth is a tool, and that's the best way to look at it. It's a tool for expanding access to care.
But this tool received lots of pushback for many reasons: money, insurance coverage, stigma, and regulations. But when COVID-19 hit, everything opened up. As healthcare facilities and hospitals had to close their doors for non-essential services, people in charge realized telehealth may be their only option to continue taking care of people like Laporto, who can't have a gap in their care.
You cannot overstate the dramatic impact COVID has had on access to care in relation to telehealth. Once federal and state officials removed many of the regulatory barriers prohibiting that and provided funding for Medicare and Medicaid for these telehealth services, it really opened the opportunity to enhance healthcare in a rural setting.
Morgan says the impact has already been seen, and this is evidenced by policymakers in DC and at state levels indicating they have no intention of going back.
I think that we are now locked into a new paradigm of how we deliver healthcare in a rural setting.
During the pandemic, the Sheridan VA, where Laporto sessions are, telehealth appointments, including mental health, primary care, etc., increased by over 1,000%. And the VA, as well as other healthcare institutions, don't want to stop this momentum, as they believe it will help them provide better care for their patients in rural places. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Godalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
This story is adapted from an episode of the Modern West podcast as part of its series on ghost towns, both past and in the making. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Now shifting from healthcare to science. Old Faithful Geyser is one of the most popular areas in Yellowstone National Park, but nearly 800 years ago, a significant climate event caused the geyser to go dormant. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel had a conversation with U.S. Geological Survey research geologist Shaul Hurwitz, who studied this strange period.
Based on a bunch of different reasons, we think that most of the big geysers in Yellowstone, including Old Faithful, are a few thousand years old. They're post-glacial. That means that after the glaciers receded from Yellowstone about 13 or 14,000 years ago, that's when geysers started forming. But exactly how long after that, we don't know. And some of them erupted and then stopped. So the same thing with Old Faithful. We don't know when it started, but we do know that the last few hundred years, it was erupting relatively constant.
What led you to look at the petrified trees around Old Faithful for evidence of previous eruptions or non-eruptions?
So I know that today, for example, there's no trees that grow on active geyser mounts. So when the geysers erupt, the water that splashes on the trees would not let them grow. So any of the geysers in the Yellowstone that you go around them, there are no trees. I read a paper that was published in the 1950s by a park naturalist describing a tree and some other trees. I didn't know how much, but he described the tree and the trees. So I knew that there was something special. When that tree was there, the geyser was probably not erupting just by standing from what we know now. So I was curious to know when that tree grew there to understand what were the conditions that led to that tree growing and what was with a geyser then that is different than it is today. So I applied with several colleagues to the National Park Service. And then when the park approved it, we went out there and sampled those wooden trees.
And what are some of the things you found?
We had a total of 41 samples that we used for radiocarbon dating. And we sent it in two batches, but the first batch we sent to the lab, and when we got the results, it was one of those too good to be true. All the results kind of clustered within about 100 years. I had to convince myself that that's a real result and not some random result. So I sent another batch, and those second batch also came exactly within the same about 100-year range, which is quite surprising. When you get radiocarbon dates, you have to do some corrections, and so we did the corrections, and after the corrections, everything came to be within about 100 years from about mid-13th to mid-14th century. So that was quite surprising. So I had to find out what were the conditions in the 13th, 14th centuries. So when I looked at climate, really, it ends up that that was just towards the end of a very dry period all over the western U.S. It's called medieval climate anomaly. All the way to California, it was a very sustained, protracted period of droughts. Geysers need water. No water. If it's extreme, probably no eruptions. If it's less water, the eruptions can still go on, but be less frequent. So what happened then is probably was a very long period of sustained long droughts that caused the geyser not to erupt. And therefore, that allowed the trees, which are lodgepole pines, which are very adaptable to occupy the mound for that duration. And then when climate conditions changed again, became a bit more wet, the geyser started erupting and the trees died and no more trees grew since.
Do seasonal droughts affect the geyser's eruption or just mega droughts?
At the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st, there were a few years with relatively dry. And when that happened, we could see that the average of the annual interval of Old Faithful slightly lengthened when there was less precipitation. So we did see that correlation that, again, what happened, the geyser didn't stop, but average over 1 year, the eruptions were a few minutes longer, the intervals between eruptions.
How does your research relate to current climate predictions?
My research and this paper is trying to say, okay, in response to any climate, regardless of what the cause is, this is what Old Faithful might do. We rely in our paper on other studies that try to use models to predict the regional climate. And we say if their models would hold, this would might happen to Old Faithful. But again, if it doesn't hold, this would not happen to Old Faithful. So, but two of my co-authors in this paper are also from the U.S. Geological Survey, and they are climatologists. They reproduced the 13th century climate based on records that we have. We did not do any reconstruction or extension into the future. That is something that I know it's sensitive, so we just use other models and say, if these models will hold, this is what will happen. Because again, the focus of this research was the finding of those trees and understanding why the geyser was erupting and not necessarily on the climate itself, which there's a lot of different paper that shows the effect of that medieval climate anomaly drought that I mentioned.
What does this mean for the future of Old Faithful and Yellowstone in general?
Yellowstone overall draws about, last few years, about 4 million visitors a year. And the Park Service has to plan the infrastructure to host these 4 million that would allow, for example, an amount of people to watch the geyser every eruption. If, as predicted, into the mid-21st century, conditions would be drier and drier, not only would we have more fires in Yellowstone, but it might be that the eruptions of Old Faithful would, for example, lengthen. The intervals would lengthen, not the eruption. The intervals between eruptions. That means that you would have, at any given point, more people waiting to see the eruptions in the Old Faithful area. So the Park Service would have to adapt the infrastructure to accommodate that change, for example. That's just one implication. If it goes for a sustained period of a lot of dryness, then maybe we'll get, you know, much longer intervals. Or if it was like that sustained drought in the 13th century, we might get even cessation if it's really extreme and sustained for a long time.
Shaul Hurwitz is a research geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey who studied Old Faithful's eruption history. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you very much.
When it comes to gender parity, tribal councils in our region have made more progress than state houses or U.S. Congress. Still, women remain underrepresented. The Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr reports.
Karen Snyder has never been afraid to use her voice.
She says she learned that from the Shoshone women who raised her on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming.
Grandmothers, mothers, very strong line of women that are very outspoken.
And that came in handy in 2016, when she was elected to the Eastern Shoshone Business Council.
You have to be assertive as a woman in the council.
Because, with notable exceptions, Snyder says the council has always been male-dominated.
And I don't say that in a judgmental way, but that's how our tribal governments have typically been comprised of.
Snyder didn't let that stop her from rising through the ranks. Last fall, she was the natural choice to replace the outgoing vice chairman, and then to take on the chairman's duties when he took medical leave soon after. Then the pandemic hit.
I've really had to step up my game substantially within the course of the last year.
She took the lead in coordinating the tribe's response, from establishing a stay-at-home order to divvying up federal coronavirus aid.
It's not like I was power-hungry or that I was territorial. I just felt like we had to get something done.
But in September's election, Snyder didn't win back her council seat. She was defeated in the primary by 6 male candidates. She says she can't be sure why, but if she had to guess.
I don't know if maybe our tribal communities are actually ready, you know, for woman leadership.
In the last 4 years, Indigenous women have achieved unprecedented political representation on the state and federal levels. But across our region, fewer than a third of tribal council seats are held by women.
There's a little change, but it's still the good old boys club.
That's Dr. Teresa Spoonhunter, a professor of tribal leadership at Central Wyoming College. She says it hasn't always been this way. Historically, Indigenous women had far more power and agency than their European counterparts. Many tribes are matriarchal. But with colonization came new ideas about gender roles.
The federal government set the template. And when they came to meet with the men because Western society is more male dominant.
And she says the work of tribal councils matters a lot in the lives of tribal citizens. They make decisions about healthcare, public safety,
tribal resource management, environmental issues, you know, economic development.
So she says it's important for these councils to contain a variety of voices and perspectives. While the gains have been slow, Spoonhunter believes that's the direction many tribes are moving in. Case in point, the Northern Cheyenne tribe made history this year when it elected 7 women to its council, including a female chair and vice chair. Northern Cheyenne citizen Dr. Desi Rodriguez Lone Bear spoke at their swearing in.
We need hope as Cheyenne people. And who better to bring us hope than our matriarchs, grandmothers, mothers, aunties, sisters, and daughters?
One of those new leaders is Silver Little Eagle. At 21, she's part of another group who are typically missing from tribal councils, young people. She says what's most needed from the tribal government during the pandemic is compassion, and the women who've been elected can provide that.
Our people have been patriarchal for the past 100 years, and men always lead the battle, but I think now is just a time of filling in the missing pieces of our government.
On the Wind River Reservation, Karen Snyder may have lost her council seat, but she was the first person the new council called to head up the Eastern Shoshone tribe's ongoing COVID-19 response. As she takes on this role, she says she's proud of how she conducted herself in office, and she hopes that by being outspoken and decisive, she showed other Shoshone women a path to leadership.
I would hope so, that maybe there's a young girl or another woman that had said, hey, she stood her ground in this environment that historically and customarily was meant for a male.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
Coming up in the program, a new form of poetry was invented with the help of a Wyoming poet. Find out about it coming up next on Open Spaces.
Is there an event that you go to annually that fascinates you, or maybe something that has happened in the past that you just want to know more about? Well, if you're between the ages of 7 and 13, you're in luck. The Kids Ask Why podcast is looking for curious kids who want to find out more. You can find out more about powwows, Yellowstone fires, or about a local event your town hosts annually. Find the application at wyomingpublicmedia.org under the podcast page.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. You've probably read poems, sonnets, or haiku. Well, this year, a new form of poetry was invented. In a matter of months, poets adopted the new form, and a new journal has been created to showcase it. We're joined now by one of its inventors, poet Lori Howe. She teaches at the University of Wyoming and is the editor-in-chief of the new journal called Gleam, the Journal of the Cadrilor. Howe explained to Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer how this type of poem came about and why it's called Cadrilor.
In August, I happened to read a series of five short poems that my fellow poet Christopher Cadra had posted on social media, and I thought, wait, is this a new form? This is extremely interesting. And so I wrote to him to ask him about it, and he said, oh, no, it's not. This is not one poem. It's five poems. It just looks like a poem, right? And so I thought, there's something here. This feels like it wants to become a new form, maybe one that we need. And I asked him if he would mind if I messed around with it a little bit. And then a third poet came into the mix, Mary Carol Hackett. And she said, I love what you guys are doing. I think I'm going to try teaching this form with my advanced poetry students, and she teaches in an MFA program, and she said it needs a name. And so she named it. She pulled Christopher Cadra's last name and my first name together and created the Cadrilor.
Now, I want to go back to something that you said, a new form that we need. Why do we need new forms of poetry?
I mean, most of the time when you read a poem, there's a narrative line that runs through the stanzas. That you're telling a story through all of the stanzas in a poem, but the Cadrilor is different. Each single stanza must be a self-contained poem that could stand alone. And ideally, it has next to nothing to do with any of the other stanzas until you get to the end. And then the fifth stanza, in order to do what we call sticking the landing, it has to illuminate what it is that ties all of these stanzas together and answers the compelling question, for what do you yearn?
And yearning is what? Yearning is something we need now?
It seems like certainly there have probably been times in America's history or the history of the world when people needed so deeply to express what they yearn for. But this feels like a particularly pivotal time for that. And I think that may be why the Cadrilor has become so popular and gone viral and global so quickly, and why we've had such an avalanche of submissions for the first issue of Gleam. People describe this form as being a kind of possession.
A possession.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning something that possesses you or something that one...
Yes. The act of writing a Cadrilor, this is a pattern response from so many of our poets. And they have described it as a feeling very much like being possessed.
Well, how about an example?
Gladly. Cadrilor 5, Thirst. 1. In my mailbox this morning, fishing boats and fog, a postcard from Maine, nourishment from the sea. Barefoot on the porch, I ate the entire thing, freshwater snow melting to salt in a halo at my feet. 2. Da Vinci was a woman. He often thought this. How else to explain such a yearning to give birth? To burst forth wings? His wife put her mouth to his, a kiss to cool, not to quench. She knew the secret, of course. Only women can fly. 3. Take the train to Cinque Terre. 5 riotous bouquets scale the cliffs, an effervescence, a circus of lemon and raspberry. After the flood, Vernazza rebuilt for violent weather, knowing the passion of water. Looking up, I see a slender, honeyed leg as sea wind takes the curtain. 4. In 1954, drought wooed Catherine Bent out of hiding. She needed no rod, no map. Her liquid core seethed with tiny, flame-haired mermaids, echolocating, diving for water. She fell to the ground, pulled by human thirst, her mouth filling with emeralds. Witch, they called her. 5. You stand on the other side of this bridge I have forgotten how to cross. I know this chasm, poppy bright with cassowaries. The ratio of thirst to recipe is often disproportionate. But oh, the blue depth of thirst. Oh, this river.
Yes, very visual, very experiential. When is a poetic form made official? I mean, is there some sort of process that makes it official, or is it official when it's adopted by a certain number of people who say, yes, this is a form?
That's an excellent question, and that's a question that we asked. We're wondering, is there a process by which to submit forms to the American Poetry Society or something and make it official? But in fact, no, there really isn't. And so it really is a question of exposure and distribution of practice and of people adopting it. We have been very fortunate to see this form being taught in a variety of different writing programs already just in the last 3 months. And people have been sharing the form and the call for submissions and the rules of the form and everything on social media. And so it's kind of gone around the world at this point.
Well, Lori Howe, congratulations on the creation of the Cadrilor. Lori Howe teaches at the University of Wyoming and is editor-in-chief of Gleam, the journal of the Cadrilor. Thank you so much for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can hear Lori Howe read more Cadrilor poems on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And we also have a link to the launch event for Gleam. It's Saturday, December 5th, and will be available on demand afterward. Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. You can find our individual segments at wyomingpublicmedia.org or on our station Facebook page. You can also listen to the podcast edition of the show on that website or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor. If you're thinking about that year-end donation, think about contributing to Wyoming Public Radio and support our local news effort. We can't bring you this program without your help. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.